Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to iHeartRadio Communities, a public affairs special focusing on the biggest issues impacting you this week. Here's Ryan Gorman.
Thanks for joining us here on iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman, and we have some important conversations lined up for you. In a moment, I'll check in with an infectious disease specialist about COVID-19 and the vaccines for children. Then for the Juneteenth holiday, I'll talk to Kelly Navies, Museum Specialist of Oral History at the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. She'll give us the backstory on Juneteenth and how this occasion became a new federal holiday. Right now, to get things started, I'm joined by Dr. Kenneth Alexander, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Nemours Children's Health in Florida. Dr. Alexander, great to talk to you. And first of all, cases of COVID-19 seem to be on the rise again in certain parts of the country, including among children. What have you been seeing lately?
Absolutely. COVID seems to be kind of like a gift that just keeps on giving. Things got better for a while. We're now seeing more cases here in Florida. And I think we're seeing the tip of the iceberg because there are so many people that are home testing. We're not hearing about those cases. So what I'm seeing is the kids in the hospital. At any one time, we've got between 1 and 4 kids. And then we're still getting the occasional child with that mysterious post-COVID inflammatory syndrome, MISC. And then the other strange thing that we're starting to see, watch this space, is we're all beginning in the infectious disease world to wonder, are we seeing more staph and strep infections in kids that have had COVID?
If you don't mind, can you expand on that for a moment, that inflammatory issue that you mentioned and also a potential connection between COVID-19 and strep and staph infections?
So MISC stands for Multisystem Inflammatory Syndrome in Children. And this was something that we began to see shortly after we were hearing about COVID cases coming out of Italy. And what seems to happen is that weeks after kids have had COVID, it's almost like their immune system just really gets revved up. And so these kids show up in our emergency rooms with fevers, abdominal pain, and sometimes with heart inflammation. Now, the good news is we've figured out how to treat these kids. And so we're quite successful. But until they're treated, some of these kids can be awful sick. So these days, if you've got a kid, especially if you know your child has had COVID, and they have several days of abdominal pain and fever, they should be seen by their doctor and specifically ask the question, could they have MISC?
And what about that staph and strep infection issue that you mentioned?
This is very early in the discussion, and this is something that my colleagues and I are just starting to see. It seems like we're seeing an upswing in infections due to staph and strep. And as we test these kids, many of these kids have antibody evidence for having had COVID-19. Now, there's some precedence for this. We know that, for instance, following influenza, we see more kinds of pneumonia due to bacteria. So we're now beginning to wonder, following COVID, are we seeing more bacterial infections? Still too early to say this is the fact. Watch this space.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined now by Dr. Kenneth Alexander, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Nemours Children's Health in Florida. One issue we've seen in adults in relation to COVID-19 is something called long COVID, where the symptoms continue on for quite a long period of time. Have we seen that in children?
We are seeing things like long COVID in children. I can't say we really know what it is. There are some people that think, well, maybe it's persistent infection, that there's still some inflammation going on. Certainly that's a possibility. But the other thing I want people to consider, especially as their kids are not bouncing back, and especially if it's teenagers, is that with all that's gone on with COVID, we've seen an upswing in things like depression and anxiety. And of course, realize that one problem doesn't exclude the other. But if we're going to make these kids better, certainly we can think about them having persistent COVID, but we also need to ask questions like, is my child depressed or anxious?
I want to spend a minute on these COVID-19 booster shots, which were recently authorized for 5 to 11-year-olds. What do parents need to know about getting their children boosted?
Boosting is an important part of vaccines, and in fact, we boost for virtually every vaccine we give. So one of the things I want to remind parents is that the idea that a vaccine needs a booster doesn't mean it's a bad vaccine. You know, we all get our tetanus booster every 10 years, and tetanus is a great vaccine. So why are we boosting? It gives you higher antibody levels. And what we've learned is as we've gone through the different variants of COVID, most recently now into Omicron, that it takes more antibody to protect people. So when we boost people, we are helping people's immune systems make more antibody. And in doing so, that protects them against these later variants like Omicron. The other thing we see is that boosting, while the vaccine doesn't always protect you from getting infected, boosted people have a very low rate of severe disease. So while we don't always prevent disease, we can certainly make it much less severe with a booster.
And then, of course, a lot of parents have questions about kids under the age of 5. Vaccines for those children currently under review at the FDA and CDC. If this authorization does go through soon, what should parents consider when trying to make that decision for their kids under the age of 5?
So this is a real exciting time in the vaccine world. And you're right, we are moving to younger and younger children. It's important to remember that especially younger children do really well with COVID. The vast majority of kids don't have any big problem with it. Now, notice I hedge that with the term vast majority. We still see some kids that get terribly, terribly sick, and we want to protect everybody. So the first reason to vaccinate young kids is to protect young kids. Also, we think that vaccination will prevent kids from getting MISC. And so even kids that get mild COVID can get this mysterious inflammatory condition. But the other reason to vaccinate kids is to protect the adults in the environment. You don't want your kid coming home from school and giving COVID to you or to grandma and grandpa. We want to protect the other adults in the environment, school teachers, your neighbors, and so on. So this is why it's important that we vaccinate young kids.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined now by Dr. Kenneth Alexander, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Nemours Children's Health in Florida. Before we get into summer activities, summer vacations, staying safe during all of that, I want to go back to what we saw during the school year. What information do we have on the spread of COVID-19 in schools?
We are seeing a lot of COVID transmission in schools. We're now seeing an increasing body of research that suggests that masks do work. Nobody likes the idea of having to wear a mask, but it's interesting with children. You know, if you talk to most young kids nowadays, it's just part of what you do. It's like putting on your underwear every day, and they don't think too much about it. If people get bent out of shape, it's often the parents. The vast majority of kids do really, really well. And again, there's this emerging body of data that mask wearing at school really does protect our kids.
All right, now let's talk about summer vacations. Those are obviously underway. And when families are traveling, whether it's to different parts of the country, maybe out of the country for summer vacations, what can they do to stay safe? And what can parents do to keep their kids safe during those summer vacations and summer activities?
Boy, are we all excited about getting out to travel again, because we've missed it for 2 years. So you're right. We've all got itchy feet, and we all want to go on that cruise or visit grandma and grandpa or go see Italy or whatever we want to do. And I think you should do it. I'm about to travel. I'm about to go visit some family. I'll be getting on an airplane. I can tell you that I wear a mask when I'm at the airport and when I'm on an airplane. I socially distance when I'm at the airport. I keep my distance from everybody. I wash my hands a lot, and I'm very careful when I eat to go sit by myself. I can't rid us entirely of risk, but by doing a few sensible things, I take the danger out of traveling. So I think we can do it quite safely. Traveling by car is safe because you're in there with your family. And then when you go into a restaurant, just make sure that everybody washes their hands and that the wait staff are wearing masks.
And last thing I want to ask you about, another aspect of summer that is an important part of life for so many families, things like summer camps. Lots of kids going to be participating in those over the next few months. What are some things that parents can do to make sure their children are safe when participating in something like that?
Summer camp is a really important part of growing up, and I encourage people to send their kids to the right kind of camp, be that music camp or arts camp or dance camp or camping camp, whatever you want to send them to. What can we do to protect our kids? Number one, make sure they're vaccinated before you send them. That way, if they're exposed to COVID, they either won't get it, or if they do get it, they'll have mild illness. And we realize with lots of kids around, the risk is not insignificant. Don't send a sick kid to camp because you're going to protect other people's kids. And it's fair to expect that other parents not send a sick kid to camp. Learn what the camp policies are. What are they going to do if your kid does get sick? Are they going to test? Are they going to send them to a doctor? What are they going to do if your kid gets sick? And finally, when you bring your child home, be cognizant of the fact that they may have been exposed, and so you might wait a few more days to make sure everybody's okay before you take them to visit elderly grandparents or somebody who's being treated for cancer or something like that. But by all means, get them to camp and let them act like kids.
Dr. Kenneth Alexander, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Nemours Children's Health in Orlando, Florida. Dr. Alexander, we really appreciate the time and insight into all of this. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. I'm Ryan Gorman here on iHeartRadio Communities. A new Gallup poll found about 6 in 10 Americans say they know a lot or some about Juneteenth, which became a federal holiday last year. That means many of us are still learning about the history and importance of Juneteenth. And to offer a comprehensive overview of the holiday, I'm joined now by Kelly Navies, Museum Specialist of Oral History at the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. Kelly, thanks so much for coming on the show. Now, before we get to the events of June 19th that led to this holiday, can you set the stage for us and run through some of what happened leading up to that date?
So you're talking about the end of the Civil War. The Civil War had officially ended in April of 1865. The Emancipation Proclamation was signed in the middle of the Civil War, and it was really a wartime strategy, and that was in January 1st, 1863, and that only had an impact on states in the Confederacy. So it did not impact you if you were in a state such as Texas that had very little Union presence. Your life did not change if you were an enslaved individual. And so you're talking about the aftermath of the Civil War. The country is somewhat still in the state of disarray. The Confederacy has not fully accepted the authority of the United States of America, so Union troops are needed to enforce the Emancipation Proclamation, and that is exactly the setting for Juneteenth.
You know, it can be kind of hard to comprehend what it must have been like to live in that time period, you know, so connected these days. We get so much information in an instant, but back then, obviously, that wasn't the case. How was word spreading about what was happening across the country?
Well, yeah, so people think that they didn't know about it at all, and that's not exactly true. There were networks amongst the enslaved when some of the enslaved had jobs, for example, that took them on the road, and whenever they did that, they would pass messages. So it isn't that they didn't necessarily know. And as well as the slave owners, of course, you had horses and trains and such carrying information. Of course, we didn't have the internet, but they were aware of what had happened with the Emancipation Proclamation. It was just that they had no intention of enforcing it. And those African Americans who were still there and under those conditions, there was nothing that they could do because their lives would be threatened if they attempted to assert their freedom. There were many who ran away, of course, but those were African Americans that were closer to Union lines.
In this specific holiday, Juneteenth, Tell us about the setting, because this is based out of Texas, and kind of set the stage for us as to how this particular date became one that we now celebrate as a federal holiday.
Sure. So on June 19th, 1865, General Gordon Granger arrives in Galveston, Texas, with about 2,000 Union troops. And some of those troops were United States colored troops. And the troops were necessary to enforce the order, Orders Number 3, which basically confirmed the Emancipation Proclamation and let them know that they were no longer legally enslaved. And this was...
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It was enforced, again, by the presence of these troops. Without the presence of these troops, it would be meaningless. If General Gordon Granger had shown up by himself, they would have said, get out of here with that news, right? But he had the troops. And this actually went on in different cities throughout Texas as well. The African-Americans who were freed as a result of that announcement and the enforcement of the Union troops, they began to celebrate Juneteenth the following year in Houston in 1866. And it spread from there, and it's been celebrated in Texas nonstop since that date. It's been a state holiday in Texas since 1979 and some other places as well. And with the Great Migration, it started to spread. I grew up in California. We were celebrating it there. The city of Berkeley has been celebrating Juneteenth since 1986. So things were building to the point where now, of course, we have this federal holiday, and people around the entire country are finally getting to know what Juneteenth is and what it's about and why it's important to celebrate.
You kind of alluded to this earlier, but I want to follow up on this point in particular. And again, I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by Kelly Navies, Museum Specialist of Oral History at the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. So Juneteenth is directly linked to Texas. And I want to go back to that time period because there was so much happening following the conclusion of the Civil War in so many different parts of the country. Can you dive a little bit deeper into why Texas is the focal point?
Yeah, well, Texas was the furthest west slaveholding state, and throughout the Civil War had very little Union presence. And so, in fact, slave owners from other states, such as Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, actually moved to Texas, some slave owners, so that they could continue to hold their enslaved people. It was like a renegade state. In some ways, it still is, right? So you really required the presence of these Union troops to enforce the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, let's remind people that the Emancipation Proclamation still wasn't the final document that ended slavery. That was the 13th Amendment that was ratified later that year, December 1865.
Taking a look at that year following the arrival of General Granger and his troops to Texas to announce that they were going to enforce the Emancipation Proclamation. From that period of time to the first anniversary of Juneteenth, the first commemoration of that day, tell us about some of the events that transpired in Texas and across the country.
Well, of course, they were supposed to, there's a clause in the order that states that they have to maintain a relationship as employer and hired labor with their former slave owners. That was an interesting clause. So they had to either stay in the area and become officially employed or try to leave the area. This is what we're talking about. This is an era of Reconstruction. This is a very, very chaotic period in American history. And, of course, there were troops throughout the state, but Texas being a very large state, it was still quite dangerous if you were trying to leave. And a lot of African Americans did try to leave in that period because many of them had been sold away in the domestic slave trade in the previous years leading up to the Civil War. There was a huge domestic slave trade that continued, and over 1 million African Americans were displaced from places like Maryland and sent deeper south. So people wanted to return to their families. They wanted to bring their families together. So many people tried to leave. A lot of people stayed. Those that stayed banded together in communities and raised money to buy land. In Houston, Reverend Jack Yates led his community, and they raised money, and they bought property in Houston and started a park called Emancipation Park, available to African Americans in Houston. And there are similar developments throughout the nation where people African Americans bought land and formed Emancipation Park so that they could have spaces to celebrate Juneteenth.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by Kelly Navies, Museum Specialist of Oral History at the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. You can find out more about all of their work on Juneteenth at nmaahc.si.edu. That's nmaahc.si.edu. So as we get further and further removed from the original commemoration of Juneteenth, what were some of the other events that have taken place, some of the notable moments that led up to more recently Juneteenth eventually becoming a federally recognized holiday?
That's a complicated question, but I can list some of the milestones. I mean, a lot of things have happened. For example, just with the celebration itself evolved. The first Juneteenth, you had actual people still living who recalled slavery, and those people would share and give testimony to their experience. They sang spirituals. Then the Black National Anthem, which is now a feature of all Juneteenth, that wasn't written until 1900, right? So it wasn't until after 1900 that becomes a part of the holiday. And what you see is as the culture evolved, as African-American culture evolved, the celebration of Juneteenth changes. And then, of course, there are different developments taking place. World War II, the Great Migration, when the African-Americans left the South thousands by the thousands and took their celebrations with them, not just Juneteenth, but other aspects of the culture as well. But Juneteenth was one of the things that traveled. Particularly, you see a lot of Texans moving out west to California. Of course, it's celebrated in Oklahoma as well. Then the celebration kind of wanes a little bit and becomes up again during the Civil Rights Movement. In 1968, you have the Poor People's Campaign, where you have activists of all races coming to Washington, D.C. to advocate for the rights of the poor. This was a campaign started by Dr. Martin Luther King and the SCLC, but it involved many different activists around the country. And at the end of that campaign, they had a Solidarity Day, and it was on June 19th, 1968, Juneteenth. So many of these activists learned about Juneteenth for the first time. And this is around the time, for example, that my father learned of the holiday and we started celebrating it in our family. They took it back to their towns where they lived throughout the country, and you see a resurgence of Juneteenth at that time. And then it settled down, and again, it was mainly celebrated in Texas, around Oklahoma, parts of California where those people moved. There were pockets, but it wasn't until the last few years when there were many, many, many incidents that occurred that kind of made people realize we need to look at our history. Like, why are we having these problems? You know, George Floyd, what's going on with that? people started to learn about the Tulsa Massacre. Why are we having these problems with race in this country? What brought us to this moment? So people are looking back to Juneteenth and the history of slavery, because clearly we haven't resolved a lot of the issues of that time period, issues of citizenship and democracy, for example, that people were fighting for in Reconstruction are still big issues today. So Juneteenth places a light on those issues and gives us an opportunity to meditate on how far we've come. What does freedom mean? What does it mean to be an American? How do we all earn and utilize the citizenship that we have as Americans? So this is a time that Juneteenth gives us a space and a place to reflect on those things and to celebrate how far we've actually come. And I think, additionally, Americans are looking for a way to come together. Like this holiday started by African Americans, but it's American history, right? The Civil War is American history. The Emancipation Proclamation is American history. General Gordon Granger was a white man. Union troops were both races. We're all races. We're all Americans of different races, right? So this is something that reflects all of our history and the continuing struggle for freedom and the demand for citizenship. As new people move into our country, they can look back at Juneteenth as a way to see where this journey began in the United States of America.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by Kelly Navies, Museum Specialist of Oral History at the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. We're talking about the history of Juneteenth within African American communities across the country. How much has the importance of this Juneteenth date, what took place so many years ago on June 19th, how much has that grown, especially as Juneteenth has become the focal point of this push to make it a federally recognized holiday, which it became last year?
Well, it's grown tremendously, not just for African Americans, but for all Americans in the past few years. I mean, as someone who has been celebrating it in my family, each year new people come. So we saw it grow with each year. Each year we would invite any and everybody around, and people would show up, and whenever they would come to our Juneteenth, they would always come the next year. They would go, this is fantastic. They loved the presentation, the cultural presentation where children would perform, and the poetry and the music, and of course the delicious food. And people would say, oh, I love this. I mean, this is like such a good mix of the generations and learning about history and celebrating our elders, but also looking towards the future and nurturing the children. And it would just grow with each year. But now, of course, as it became a federal holiday, one of the best pieces of news that we've had in this difficult last 2 to 3 years, more and more people are learning about it. And I believe that it will continue to grow.
You mentioned a couple of things that many in this country are still learning more and more about, Juneteenth being one of them. Also, the Tulsa race massacre was something you mentioned. Was there anything else looking back at that time period from the end of the Civil War, Juneteenth, that June 19th date, through, you know, the next couple of decades, that really stands out to you that you think is notable and is worth discussing further, like we have begun to do with Juneteenth, the end of slavery, with things like the Tulsa race massacre?
Well, it was, Reconstruction is a rich, rich, rich period. And right now we have an exhibition in our museum that will be up for a few more months that focuses specifically on Reconstruction and all the different facets of American life that it touched. I mean, this is when you see the roots of public education in the United States of America. People don't understand that the newly freed African Americans were some of the first to push for the education, for public education, because of course that was one of on the top things on their list, and they had been unable to go to school while they were enslaved. And one of the first things that they were eager to do was to get out and learn how to read and write, and to have their children have access to an education. So that's a huge issue, and we see that right now education is still a huge issue, the state of public education and what is taught right in the schools. Voting rights, that was another big issue. Black men earned the right to vote with the 14th Amendment, and with the 15th Amendment, rather, those 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were those Reconstruction Amendments. Women, of course, did not have the vote of any race at that time, but Black men started to exercise the right to vote. But even as they were exercising the right to vote, they did that under the threat of violence. Many were killed trying to exercise the right to vote then, and of course, Reconstruction, there was a backlash to Reconstruction starting in 1877 when the Union troops were removed from the South, and continuing up to the passage of Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, the separate but equal law. And then you see voting rights almost completely taken away from African Americans throughout the South until what we know of as the modern civil rights movement, right? 60 years later.
Right.
So all of this is going on in the Reconstruction era, education, early business, voting rights, even the beginnings of women's rights movements. Of course, white women, but Black women as well, were starting the beginnings of their own convention and struggle for civil rights as well. You see the roots of that during the era of Reconstruction. So it's a very rich period. And it was a scary period as well. I mean, violent. African Americans who were once chattel, right? They had value. At the end of the Civil War, they no longer had value. So their lives weren't worth much, and many of them were killed trying to assert their rights and to do basic things like own property, learn how to read and write.
Kelly Navies, Museum Specialist of Oral History at the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. You can learn more at nmahc.si.edu. Kelly, we really appreciate the time. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us about the history of this Juneteenth holiday.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, and I'm actually just getting started, but thank you.
All right, and that'll do it for this edition of iHeartRadio Communities. As we wrap things up, I want to offer a big thanks to all of our guests and, of course, to all of you for listening. If you want to hear previous episodes of the show or on your iHeartRadio app, just search for iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman. We'll be back same time, same place next weekend. Stay safe.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.